Thanks, Martin. Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and thank you to April's Agenda for saving the best topic until last. This is targeted standards level review of disclosure. So this is a project that we have discussed with GPF before, most notably at the joint meeting with CMAC last June, and in light of the advice we received at that meeting and other feedback that we've received, the board decided to select IAS 19 and IFRS 13 as the subjects of its targeted standards level review. Now, by way of reminder, a key piece of this project is that the board is exploring how to most effectively develop and utilise in the standards detailed and specific disclosure objectives of users of financial statements. So with that in mind, we on the team have spent the last few months having a lot of conversations with investors. That's been with individual investors and with very small groups. And we did our feedback in that way in order to get a real detailed understanding of the objectives that they have. So we talked to them about the analysis that they perform with respect to the disclosures they get on these two standards, the inputs that they most need, and what they want to do with the information. We also asked investors, in light of their objectives, what information would most effectively meet them. So we approached it with something of a blank page position, i.e. what is the dream from the investor perspective? What would you most like to have? And the feedback that we received is summarised in Agenda Paper 6A for today's meeting. That's the Word document one. Now, you'll see that that paper contains quite a lot of detail. So it gives a big picture piece on each of our two standards. It summarises the primary objectives of users and the information that they identified as being useful in meeting those objectives. And the paper also links the objectives and the potential items of information together. Now, in terms of the level of detail in that paper, the first thing to say about it is that at this stage, this is absolutely not a set of proposals. It's not that the IASB is at this point thinking of turning those suggestions into a set of disclosure requirements in the standards. Instead, the first step in exploring the development of objectives very much for us has been to identify what is the ideal position for investors and then extend that outreach out to other stakeholders to have some balanced discussions and give the board the best information to make some decisions going forward. So with that in mind, we provided this level of detail very consciously because we wanted to share with you everything we've heard from investors so that you as preparers have opportunity to comment on any aspect of it that you would wish to. Now, the other fact pertaining to the level of detail is the interesting question of how we would then like to manage this meeting. So you will have seen in the slide pack on slides 3 and 4, we provided some information on that. And essentially, we feel that the best way we can get information from you to feed into the board's thinking is to ask for your thoughts on the consequences of the potential items of information that investors feel would satisfy their objectives. So there we're thinking about things like costs of preparation of those potential items, audit consequences, whether there's different information that you think might meet the same objectives but perhaps be easier to prepare, and indeed whether you'd see any benefits of the items mentioned. Now, if you were to provide us that feedback on each and every item listed, we could be here for a very long time. And as noted on slide 4, we are not asking you to comment on each and every possible item that I've spoken about there. That said, if you want to do that, and also as mentioned on slide 4, we're very happy to receive a more detailed level of feedback separately. And to those members that have already provided that, thank you very much. But what we would like to focus on in today's meeting, and as noted on slide 3, is the items that you consider of highest priority. So that might be because you look at them and see a real red flag in terms of potential consequences for preparers. It might be because you look at them and think you really support those items being disclosed or objectives leading to those items being required. So what we're going to ask you to do for each of IAS 19 and IFRS 13 is, with the list of potential items of information in mind, tell us your biggest priority thoughts, as just described. So we'd like to start with IAS 19, and the list of information in question is listed on slides 17 and 18. Just to note, with regards to this standard, the big picture in terms of the feedback that we've heard is very much that investors have some real quite specific and important objectives here. For example, a lot of investors repeatedly talk to us about the importance of cash flow information and things that would facilitate their ability to do some forecasting, and you'll see that coming through both the objectives and the items of information. The other big picture piece that came through was that with IAS 19, a lot of investors consistently said to us that they don't always get information that necessarily meets those objectives entirely today. And whilst we have not had technical discussions with the board yet, and I am now giving you my personal opinion only, it's possible that with this one, we might in the coming months be talking to the board about the possibility of reconsidering IAS 19 disclosures at quite a fundamental level in terms of what objectives are we trying to satisfy, what are we aiming for, and something of a complete reconsideration there. So there are potential real benefits for both investors and others of this process. But in the interests of the board being able to have well-informed and thorough discussions, we are now looking to hear other stakeholder opinions on the investor position that is described in these papers. So with that summary, I will ask you to focus on slides 17 and 18 and share with us your thoughts on the items listed.
Ian.
Happy to share my thoughts. I have one side topic before. Mm-hmm. IAS 19 is called employee benefits. Mm-hmm. It's not called pensions. And when I looked at it for our financials, we have 6.5 pages on pensions and 0.5 page on employee benefits. And when I look at this list, it's all pensions. So before we get onto these, did you completely ignore short-term employee benefits, long-term employee benefits, termination benefits? Are these of no interest to people, or did we simply not ask?
No, we did ask. So the scope was IAS 19 disclosures in totality, and we mentioned this in the more detailed paper, but it didn't get into the slide pack. What we heard from investors with regard to other elements of IAS 19 disclosures was that, you know, they just didn't have the same level of feedback to give us as they do with the defined benefits scheme. So their key areas of exposure and interest and the key objectives that they were putting to us related to the defined benefit schemes. With regard to other elements, as noted in the paper, the lists were relatively short. They feel they were getting information today that satisfied them. And in the there's a secondary table on IAS 19 in the more detailed paper on, for example, contribution schemes.
Because I find that surprising, because, if, for example, if you look at wages and salaries, IAS 19 short-term employee benefits requires no split. And if you look at sort of a lot of the stuff that's in the press, accounting scandals, financial crisis, the whole sort of difference between what is fixed salary and what is bonus salary, how a bonus is calculated, you know, particularly not only in the banking sector, but this is very much a topic. And in fact, IAS 19 requires no split of that whatsoever. You just put it all in one bucket, and I'm surprised nobody's concerned about that. Mm-hmm. It's certainly something that I hear, but just to pass on that. And that's just an example. I think termination benefits, and I'm not talking any executive remuneration disclosures, cut it for the top guys, but some very big numbers go into termination benefits. If you look at the disclosures in requirements in IAS 19, you've got to prepare us to have a complete free pass on that. I'm just surprised nobody, I think maybe people just have such low expectations, they don't even worry about it anymore. But I would encourage, if we're looking at IAS 19, to me is a classic case where there's maybe the right volume of disclosure, but there's too much of the wrong sort of disclosure and not enough of the right sort of disclosure. And I think there's an overemphasis on the whole defined benefit. And defined contribution plans have a complete free pass as well. So I'd sort of maybe, if we ever get to a more advanced stage, I think that's something to be looked at. With the specific proposals, I think what I hear is people are really only interested in two things. How much cash is going to go out of the door over the next 5 years? They're not interested in discounting. They're not interested in defined contribution or defined benefit or any of this stuff. They're just interested in how much cash goes out of the door, whether it's the regular company contributions, whether they're any discretionary contributions, to what extent contributions might be required by the local funding status. And there you're linked into the local statutory status of the pension funds, not the IAS 19 numbers. That's the first thing. The second thing is, ultimately, if everything goes wrong, how much are the shareholders on the hook for? And that is sort of the ultimate position, you know. And then you come, you know, if it's a complete DC plan, the company can sort of wash its hands. Whether they would do so is a good question. And then with the various shades of defined benefit plans, how much could the company be on the hook for if it all goes wrong? What they're not interested in is these pages and pages of Sudoku tables that support... They are. They support these fake assets and liabilities in the balance sheet that nobody believes and nobody's interested in. And that's, to me, this is the... IAS 19 is a great case study, which is why I'm glad we close it. We have these funny accounting, goodwill's another one, they're like a magnet for disclosure. We know there's something funny in the debits and credits, and in order collectively to cover ourselves, we just pile in a whole load of disclosure. So it's as if to say, we know this number's a bit fishy, but just to cover ourselves, here's a load of other stuff, so don't blame us later if it all goes wrong. I think you could cut out all of that stuff. I think we put that stuff in there because we feel an obligation to somehow justify these numbers on the balance sheet. I think that's all it is. It's a passive-aggressive sort of pass the problem up. It's not trying to be helpful to people. I really don't think... I haven't met anyone who's interested in all the stuff that backs up. They're interested in the assumptions on mortality, what you're using there. So, to the extent that these factor into the ultimate obligation, yes, folks are interested in that. What, you know, if you're using up-to-date mortality tables already, how do you calculate that? What discount rate? I don't think they've got the cash will go out on an undiscounted basis. So the discount rate is utterly irrelevant. It will go out. The question is how much cash goes out and when does it go out? And that's rather more the focus. So giving a sort of net present value number with discounted is not really that helpful. You really want sort of the cash flows 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, year 5 to year 10, year 10 to year 20, undiscounted. And what assumptions have you put in there? And I think then if you do all of that, that really rather hits what folks want. And then you can cut out some of the other stuff.
What cash flows are you talking about, Ian? Are you talking about the cash flows relating to service to date, or are you talking about total cash flows from the scheme for the next 5, 10, 20 years?
Future cash flows.
So all of the cash flows.
Yeah, I think you've got the reg... I mean, thinking of our pensions, you know, some of them are... there's a fixed contribution. Like our Swiss one, the company pays in a fixed amount every month. Some of our other ones, the company pays in a amount as needed. And if it's a funded plan, there's a fund of assets. If the fund of assets are doing great, then the company doesn't put in money. If the fund of assets are not doing so well, the company has to put in some more money. So all of that... I think they're interested in what... You said it correctly in your opening statement. Folks are interested in how much cash is going to go out of the door. And they...
So it's a cash forecast for 20, 30, 50 years you're talking about?
Yeah, and principally the actuaries have that because they must have that information in order to actually do the calculation of the DBO and the plan assets. So to some extent, these assumptions are made.
But that's a very different basis from what's in the... number that's booked in the accounts at the moment.
Yeah, the number.
Because it's not limited just to service today, it's over the future service life of all current and future employees.
I'm not sure folks make that. I understand your point, but I'm not sure people don't have it's like tax. I don't think people have a big knowledge of these plans. They need to model it and they want to know how much cash is going to go out of the door for whatever reason.
Okay, Richard?
Buried in agenda reference 6A, there is a comment from users that said that some of the disclosures would be useful only in certain situations, for example, when the plan and its liability are significant relative to the size of the entity. And that, at the discussions we had with the analysts at the last joint meeting, it's clear that for some companies, the most important item that affects the future of the company is the pension plan. And those analysts want a lot of information about pensions. So it seems to me you could structure the disclosure to say if the pension liabilities or employment liabilities are so fundamental to the company, then there's a whole bunch of extra disclosure that would be required or recommended. And without requiring a lot of that disclosure for every company. I do agree that it would be useful and it wouldn't be that difficult for us to prepare separating normal contributions from special funding contributions. And funding contributions are usually agreed for a period of 5 years or 10 years in some jurisdictions. So we could project normal, expected normal contributions and expected funding contributions from the company for the next 5 years. That I don't think would be particularly onerous, and I think that would be very useful to analysts. The disclosures about wider sensitivity and combinations of sensitivity, preparers do a lot of sensitivity analysis and disclosure on other areas of the financial statements, which we can manage quite easily through our own models. But when you get into these pension sensitivity, you've got to go back to your actuaries all the time to get combinations of sensitivity. And it's particularly if they're non-linear. And that becomes very expensive and more subject to audit. So that's quite onerous to do.
Trent?
A number of thoughts. Reading through this, I thought a lot of it reminded me of U.S. GAAP, and I know it's probably not something I should say too loud in this room, but a lot of it is very, very similar to U.S. GAAP, and I'm wondering if that was an expectation driven out of the user group that they've seen that elsewhere. Echo again, you know, cash is what people have been asking about. We do all the IS 19 stuff, and then we layer in a bunch of non-GAAP stuff that actually is the cash number that the people want in terms of the regulators are indicate what your funding is going to have to be over the next year, and that's disclosed. The sensitivity, if we think into IFRS 7 and somewhere in the Appendix B, it talks about reasonable changes or reasonably expected changes in items that affect financial instruments. If you apply that reasonably expected, 100 basis point change in some of that stuff is pretty significant increases or decreases. And again, we think about, you know, we refer to it as a pension benefit standards regulation is the Canadian piece, but so we actually disclose our liability under the PBSR calculation, which one of the gentlemen over here was talking about, sort of like an acid test, you know, what would you have to settle it for today? That's what the PBSR number will give you. So, again, non-GAAP, but.
Okay. I thought it was right.
Thank you. I'm just reading down the list and trying to pick on ones which would be a challenge in practice. Some background, I'm also a trustee of one of our pension schemes, the largest pension scheme, so I see it from multiple angles, and actually this is an area that I'm quite interested in, so it's a, so I'm coming from a position of different elements of knowledge. So in terms of the first one, it depends what disaggregation we're looking at as to how easy that might be. Something to bear in mind that quite often we do have what we refer to as stranded members. So members of the pension scheme which relate to divested companies or companies that emerge. So it may be no longer very clear on some of these categorisations. If we're talking about which country the pension scheme is managed from, then that might be straightforward. But you may have employees that are a member of one pension scheme but actually are currently working elsewhere in the world. I think the next one to pick up on, so 3 to 4, on the assumption side, I think if users are looking for a tighter description of assumptions, So actually, which mortification use, what future improvements do you have, then that is not too difficult to explain, but maybe voluminous. And the context is, so to repeat Richard, I mean, some companies are quite frankly a pension scheme with a company attached to it. You know, the scheme liabilities are so dominating that they are, you know, it's absolutely critical. But if we impose this on everyone, then Ian's 6 pages becomes 12 for every single company, and for some, that's just going to be information overload. So in terms of the assumptions, if it's more description, it's doable. If it's why those assumptions are the right ones, then it's probably not the job of the preparers to educate users on pension scheme accounting. So just to get a balance there. I think number 6 could be a challenge, because not all of the valuations are under the company's control. So as a trustee, we have a valuation basis, but that is not dictated by the company. So if the company is expected to explain why their assumptions are different to the trustee's assumptions, that feels odd, explaining someone else's action. I think going down to 8, so actual rate of return on specific asset types, that may not be as easy in practice as it sounds. And if you start putting numbers there, you would then feel constrained to probably put quite a lot of explanation in. You know, most pension schemes of reasonable size have a portfolio of assets. Not all of them perform well, but you've got a portfolio. The idea is that you're spreading your risk. If you start putting individual returns down, then the users may challenge them. Well, why did that one perform so badly? Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes they do. You would end up then possibly feeling constrained to write a lot of words to explain those performances. Schedule of expected future benefit payments. So it includes a maturity analysis. So this is coming down to what I think Ian was saying earlier. If we are really going to start disclosing future cash flows by year for the next 50 years, then that could be incredibly challenging. Mm-hmm. That's not the basis on which ICE 19... the basis on which ICE 19 values liability allows some roll forward between discrete points. So the scheme that I'm involved in, there's an evaluation every 3 years where all this stuff is trued up, but then for each of the intervening 3 years, then you've got an assumption on transfers out, members leaving, the reasons, members retiring, and so on. If you start trying to profile those cash flows, that could be quite expensive and challenging to actually disclose and meet any requirements.
Okay. I mean, one thing we have heard on that from some quarters is that, you know, I think there are some users that would think the information they're interested in terms of potential future exposure, they would expect to be the same as the information that those managing the scheme would be interested in monitoring and keeping for you know, for their own use. Yes. So I just wonder if given, you know, your experience, there's any item of information that you think might, you know, meet both sets of needs that could potentially be the
scheme. So if we're looking at just that point on future cash flows, so the scheme that I'm involved in, the trustees are interested in that, mm-hmm. but using their assumptions,
okay,
not using the IS 19 yep. assumptions. So therefore, you know, future yeah. inflation, all those kind of things will be on a different basis. So the cash flows you come up with will be different.
Okay.
So if we need an IS 19 basis, then that would be a new exercise. Oh, and by the way, the pension year end isn't the same as the accounting year end. So you've got another difference as well, even if you were using the trustee numbers. So there's a number I've missed out. You know, future cash flow commitments, absolutely. You know, where you've got commitments that have been made by the company, then understand why they would be disclosed and why the users find it useful.
There we go.
I think that most of the information in this table already exists. Within the company, so the cost of providing that information in the financial statements, I don't think it would be too excessive, except for the cost of the human resources that would be necessary to prepare the information actually to include in the financial statements. I think information requested in item 5 here, I think that one might be very complicated depending on how these wider sensitivity analyses are to be prepared, not only for the company but also for the auditors to evaluate the how their information was prepared. So as for the expected benefits, I really have some doubts regarding how this information is actually used by the users, because my opinion is that you need to be a real expert to understand most of that information, and even experts to use that information to make their own projections or to change something that was projected by the company have a hard time doing so. So, for instance, our company had an entire team just focusing on working with these projections besides the actuarial team, and to understand how these assumptions could change the projections. And I have some doubts regarding the actual benefits that this information could have for users.
So, sorry, could I clarify on that? Is that relating to a particular item of information? Or
in general. I mean, some items here, they are, pretty basic to understand the plan itself. But other items regarding the assumptions and specifically the sensitivity analysis, I'm pretty unsure about how useful it will be for users to actually comprehend how the future cash flows could be impacted by the actual changes. I was noticing in paper 6A, and I found it, I would also like to say I really liked this exercise here. I found it very interesting to see how the demands from users was elaborated here. Very, very interesting. But I found kind of disturbing to see 19D here in table 1. Paper 6A, they mentioned here that there is a need of information to see if they can trust the valuation that is being provided by the company. And so besides providing information to help users understand the impact that information, the impacts in future cash flows, providing also information to help them trust the information that is being provided. You see, we have auditors, we have a whole internal control structure, and also having to provide information to gain the trust of the users, something that I found kind of disturbing here. And that's it.
Okay, thanks. Sandra?
The most relevant information, I think, is going to be the future cash flows, although I'd probably go out, for the next 5 years. Certainly the next year when you have, you know, what your funding requirements will be more important. On the first one, where you're talking about disaggregation of amount recognized in the financial statements, just keep in mind that Some of the service costs could be capitalized into PP&E or inventory or other places on the balance sheet. So when you went back into the detail, I think some people say expensed. That's not the same as your cost. And we're not going to know where that all ended up either, because you're going to have benefit rates that you apply for that. The ones that I think will be costly are where you would have to have the actuary go and do incremental calculations. So where you're, where they want multiple simultaneous assumption changes for sensitivity analysis, those are going to add a lot of cost to have all each of the actuaries go and do that. In the disclosures on plan assets, the only one that I think they really need additional information on are your level threes. Your auditors are looking at your, I mean, your level ones are information's right out there. Level two, the auditors are already looking to make sure that you're picking up the appropriate assumptions and determining how to calculate those amounts. So level three is really where you would need incremental information on it, because you're making assumptions there that aren't readily that require more judgment from both the auditor and the company's perspective. But to add a bunch of incremental disclosures on level two, I just don't see where you're going to get any incremental information that's valuable. The one area that I was kind of surprised that wasn't on here was a breakdown between your funded and your unfunded plans. Companies are going to fund the plans where there's a tax benefit or regulatory requirement to fund your plans, and they may not or likely will not fund plans where there's no tax incentive to do that. And that breakdown, I think, could be useful to the users. I think that was, those were my main points.
Okay, thanks. Gary?
Well, I'll make it quick because I know we got a second subject to go to. And by listening to this discussion, was actually remarkably similar to the CMAQ yesterday. More focus on cash and less focus on some of the other details that are typically disclosed. I think my takeaway is, and Sandra, you had said what I was going to say, is, you know, for lease runoff, debt runoff, 5-year cash flow seems to be sufficient. You know, for stuff that's closer to the capitalization of the company than this is. And, Stephen, you said project 50 years. I mean, that's, the actuaries can do it, but sampling with replacement and backfilling employees and the same plan, I think strikes me is, you'll see either the footnote in the face of the balance sheet, the liability that is owed at, in total. And, you know, a few years the runoff, you know, or the cash funding into it. I think we should probably maybe ask the room, or we can take it offline because I know we're pressed a bit on time. So we say cash flows. There's cash flows out of the trust fund to beneficiaries, and there's cash flows into the trust fund. And there's likewise, there's cash flows for the unfunded plan off the balance sheet to beneficiaries. I think we should probably clarify when we say cash flows, what do we mean? But instinctively, I would say it's from the reporting entity out, whether it's in the trust fund or the beneficiaries, I think is what mean that what comes out of the trust is less important, as I'm deducing the conversation.
Okay, Patricia.
I have sent a detailed note to you, item by item. Therefore, I'm not going to cover all the items. I'm going to cover only just few items. There are quite a number of items where you see that I have agreed with the staff proposal. But for example, item number 2, where the BC50 is already covering that. I mean, in any case, an entity is supposed to give that information. But then, as I said, that BC50 is a very important item. It can be brought in the standard. Whether that makes any difference or not is another matter. But I think it's a valid demand. But there are several items you will find that the standard, existing standard, is already mandated to mandating you to give that information. I don't understand how any entity can get out of that. So therefore, what they are wanting, what the users are wanting, is already provided paragraph by paragraph, BC by BC, I have quoted. You can go through that. I don't understand how any entity can get out of that. There are certain items which is quite surprising, shall I say, which is item number 5. Item number 5, what they're demanding is that if there are variables, factors, they're wanting a sensitivity analysis. In any case, sensitivity analysis, in any case, we are giving. The standard, existing standard demands that. What they are wanting is that sensitivity analysis where the variables are moving simultaneously. Now, to make the demand a practical demand, they have chosen, I don't know whether they or you, I don't know, two of the changing variables and 2 plus 2 plus 1, 5 of the variables, right? So that gives 15 results. It's a totally impractical situation because if there are 6-7 variables and all the 6-7 variables can go simultaneously, move simultaneously, infinite number of results will come out of this exercise. So therefore, do not trivialize this demand by only quoting a fictitious example. So the demand is a demand calling for infinite number of sensitivity results. I have not understood why this has not turned down at that stage itself.
Just to explain that one slightly in case it's helpful, many of the users we spoke to had views on sensitivity and the importance of width of the analysis and multiple assumptions. And ultimately, you know, and I am doing this at a high level, we heard lots of views. What they want to be able to do is take their own view on, well, I want to do this sensitivity analysis. I want to change this assumption by this much and see what the consequence is. And the benefit of wide analyses and an understanding in sort of non-linear examples of how things will move in different circumstances, how different assumptions interact, enables users to almost do their own analysis of the particular scenario.
Have to make an assessment of what non-linear and non-linear.
So the example in the appendix was one way in which that might be achieved. It's not to say that's something that we're you know, at this point suggesting. It's an example that's been put forth that's helpful for discussion.
And more interesting part is that this particular problem was envisaged in BC 239, and then the board decided that although the scenario analysis could provide more useful information, the complexity and the cost of producing the information would outweigh the benefits. Now, I don't think that the situation has changed much after that.
And it's not
cash. Anyway, I rested there. I mean, item number 5 is a surprising item. 6 is another item. 6 says that if there are more than one valuation, the IAS 19 valuation and other valuation, give a reconciliation between the valuation, different valuations. Now, for 19 valuation, I'm going to an expert because 19 valuation, I don't know. I mean, as a preparer, I don't know how to do it. I go to I retain an expert to do the job, and then I incorporate that in my financial statement. Likewise, for each individual valuation, I go to different experts, and they give me the result. Now, the demand is that I reconcile between what I do not know and what I do not know. Now, for doing this reconciliation, I have to engage another consultant. Doesn't matter. I'm prepared to engage another consultant. But that consultant will know the nuances of valuation A and valuation B and valuation C and D. I'm just highlighting this just to ask this question, whether the demand is a practical demand or not. A, B, what is going to come out of this? How their understanding of the financial statement is going to be enriched by looking at this reconciliation? And most of the other valuation requirements are arising out of local demands, right? So the local demands may be are satisfying some purpose, I do not know. But then what is going to come out of this reconciliation? That is my question.
Okay.
Yeah, one thing.
Should we come later back to you?
Okay, well, I stopped here because other comments I have already given. Please consider those comments, and that is my request.
Okay, thanks, Shirat.
Yeah, I would like to make a few observations. Firstly, I think for most of the analysts, the disclosure on pension is a black box. They really don't understand what we are trying to explain. That is the reason being the disclosure is too descriptive and too detailed enough. In fact, in my organization, we used to have 10 pages of disclosure, cut down into 6 a few years back, but still, we cannot cut down further. So I am glad that you have selected for target level review of this standard, which it deserves, number one. Number two, the analysts or the investors would be looking for information as to what is the maximum financial exposure they have for relating to this company, which has undertaken these type of arrangements wherein they are contributing to defined benefit plan. That is what they would be more interested. Is there any off balance sheet liability which is not there on the balance sheet? That is something they would be interested to know. Especially a company which has engaged in a multi-employer scheme, it is possible that if other employers fail to fund, then this entity would be required to fulfill those obligations. And I think that needs to be explicitly stated in the financials so that the reader can understand what are they exposed to. I think currently, current standard may not cater to that requirement. Number two, what we disclose in the financial statement is net defined benefit obligation, which is gross obligation less value of assets. What we are disclosing is the net obligation. It does not necessarily mean what is the exposure, overall exposure for the investor. Number three, recently the pension regulatory authorities have become more and more strong, and they have more say in the way in which the pension funds work than the contractual obligation with the company has entered into with the pension funds. For example, last year there was a case relating to gender equalization plan. A lot of companies have been affected by the court decision, which was not envisaged by any of the companies. So it was accounted in 2018 as charged to the P&L rather than change in the obligation liability. I think what investors would be interested is more on what is the real deficit of the fund and what is the expected cash outflow over the next few years. The focus here is what is the deficit and what is the cash exposure or the cash outflow for the organization. And in addition to that, the current sensitivity should also continue. But what I feel is the real problem is too much of disclosure, which will make the analyst not able to comprehend what the real issue is here. It's like saying if you want to hide a tree, just throw it in a forest so it gets hidden. So that's exactly happening with so much of information on IAS 19 disclosure. I think this is a good approach, what you are doing now. I hope that would benefit both the preparers as well as investor community.
Richard?
Just one comment about the level of disclosure. So as context, we have about 60 DC plans, 19 DB plans, and there are two large DB plans which account for 80% of the liability. So for those two large plans, we give the sensitivity, we describe the mortality, we do all these, a lot of the detailed disclosures. And I think that would satisfy a lot of these requirements. But where you talk about disaggregation of amounts recognized in the financial statements and disaggregation by member type, et cetera, that would imply that I've got to do the same thing for 19 plans, most of which are not material, and then add them up. Whereas I don't think that would add any extra value compared to giving the disclosure about the two large plans. Okay. So you might want to bear that in mind in the way that you've phrased the disclosure.
Okay, thanks. Now we have only 7 minutes for...
We do. Luckily, Martin, we were anticipating the discussion on IFRS 13 might be a bit shorter. So I will just take 1 minute to comment. The question on IFRS 13 is the same question, and the items under discussion are on slides 19 and 20. The only thing that I will add in terms of overview is that the feedback we got at a high level was very different on this, and in fact the contrast between the feedback on the two standards is something we're finding incredibly useful ourselves in terms of thinking about the development of objectives. So on IFRS 13, whilst users did flesh out their objectives for us and did have some suggestions, the overarching message was that they are broadly happy with the information they get today. One big picture piece they did raise quite consistently was that they felt the application of materiality was absolutely key to these disclosures. And again, speculating without having asked the board to discuss this in any detail as yet, one possibility that we might end up thinking about is looking at the development of objectives as a way of facilitating the application of judgment and helping around materiality judgments without necessarily anticipating really different information that companies are aiming for. It would be more about applying judgment and materiality. So with that in mind, I would ask you to share your views on slides 19 and 20.
Talia?
I think the financial institutions that have the most impact from this standard. And actually, I've already told it on the last meetings that we never had a question on that disclosures. We're spending days and even weeks to prepare all the disclosures, and we never, ever had any questions on that. On the issues raised here, it's actually not a question how to do it. I would argue on the sensitivity analysis with all of these multiple assumptions, because what is maybe more relevant and what I've seen in our risk management, if we would give three scenarios, normal, stress, and positive, which would give more information to the users rather than the whole bench of variations on these assumptions. And I would not definitely support extending disclosures on level two. Okay. It would not give any additional value, because all the risk lies with the level three, where lots of subjective inputs and subjectivities lies. And if we came with the valuation, then it's the matter of auditors to confirm. On the level two, it's just in the middle. There is something not on the market, but it's not so subjective that it lays to level three. So it would be okay with the current level of disclosures, I would say. So.
Okay, Murilo?
Again, like in the comment I've made IAS 19. In Table 3, in Paper 6A, I noticed that two of the objectives, B and E, they are related to the need of the users to obtain information to see if they can trust the disclosures that we are providing. And these objectives, they are related to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, specific items of information in Table 4. So it's almost the majority of the disclosures they are requesting here is to see if they can trust the information that we are providing. It's disturbing. just wanted to point it out. Mm-hmm. Even though I really liked the exercise here, I found it really, really interesting to see how these discussions are being evolving and how the requirements are being produced.
Sandra?
The same comments that I had on the pensions apply here in regards to some of the measurements. in particular on fair value measurements when you would have to change multiple assumptions. If you're doing an acquisition, this could be extremely costly. For example, if you have a certain price assumption for a asset, your development plan will change if that price changes, and so your discounted cash flows will change. So it has a ripple effect that is, would be very costly to create these models to be able to do it. And then, again, I don't, there's questions in here about how did you determine the classification. Well, the classification is driven by the standard, and there's not a whole lot of judgment involved there. I mean, level one is very specific. Level two is, you know, it's restricted as well. The real question is how do you do your level threes, and what are the assumptions so that people can understand that better. So I think that's similar types of questions or responses versus the other one.
Tita.
Here also I sent you a note in the important ones, number two. They're wanting narrative information about how an entity has determined which level of the instrument belongs to. I've said that, yes, this is a genuine demand. It can be considered. Item number four. As of now, IFRS 13 does not provide any sensitivity analysis. Whereas 36, 19, 7, they all provide sensitivity. So I said that this can be done for IFRS 13 also. On the question of post-tax, this taking the numbers in post-tax basis. Now, if the item is entering into an OCI, I have no problem in taking the post-tax numbers. If it is not an OCI item, I have definitely a problem in taking it post-tax. It will be a unique thing. We don't do it for any other items. In the, most of the other items, I have said that the standard already provides, so therefore there is no need for that. Only item number 10, where they talk about the demand house desegregation, said that IFRS 13 should be amended to include disclosure of concentration risk in respect of non-financial assets and liability. So concentration risk is something which is not contained already in this standard. It should be considered.
Okay. Then, thank you very much for your comments on that.
Thank you. That was extremely useful. And if anyone did want to share any more detail, our contacts are in the slide.
Okay, that will finalize our public session. We will have a 10-minute break, and then we come back from admin session.